This is VOA News via remote. I'm Coral Bowman. Facebook has taken down content that spread lies in Israel against coronavirus vaccinations as the government seeks to drum up support for the program, the Justice Ministry said on Sunday. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this weekend became the first person to be vaccinated in Israel. Opinion polls show some two-thirds of the public want to follow suit. Sydney was isolated from the rest of Australia on Sunday after all of the country's states and territories imposed travel restrictions on its residents as a coronavirus cluster in the city grew to around 70 people. The Australian Capital Territory sent a stern "Do not come to us" message to Sydney, warning its residents they would be quarantined for 14 days if they arrived. In China's Wuhan, the original epicenter of the COVID-19 outbreak, the city's residents are returning to normal life. It's been almost 7 months since the city recorded a locally transmitted case of the disease due to a strict citywide lockdown and a mass testing event of almost all of the city's 11 million residents. Thailand plans to test more than 10,000 people after a record daily surge in coronavirus cases to over 500, most of which were among migrant workers linked to a shrimp market near the capital, an official said on Sunday. South Korea reported a record 1,097 new coronavirus cases on Sunday, including an outbreak in a Seoul prison that infected 188 people, this as the country's latest wave of COVID-19 worsens. Europe is expected to start a massive vaccination campaign after Christmas, following the United States and Britain, which have already started using the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, and Russia and China are also now using their own domestically produced vaccines. This is VOA News. Taiwan's Navy and Air Force were deployed on Sunday as a Chinese aircraft carrier group led by the country's newest carrier, the Shandong, sailed through the sensitive Taiwan Strait the day after a U.S. warship transited the same waterway. While it's not the first time China's carriers have passed close to Taiwan, it comes at a time of heightened tension between Taipei and Beijing, which claims the democratically ruled island as its own territory. Austrian prosecutors said Sunday that another two suspects had been arrested for alleged involvement in the November 2nd terrorist attack in Vienna. The two men, one of whom is a 26-year-old Austrian of Afghan origin, were arrested on Friday, a spokeswoman for the prosecutor's office told media. She declined to reveal the nationality of the other suspect. Last month, an Islamic State supporter who had been convicted and imprisoned for trying to join the IS group in Syria went on a shooting rampage in central Vienna, killing four people. The 20-year-old gunman, a dual Austrian-Macedonian national, was shot dead by police. 18 people have since been detained in Austria and Switzerland in connection with the attack, and the government also ordered the closure of two mosques in Vienna frequented by the attacker. Nepal will likely head to the polls next year after parliament was abruptly dissolved on Sunday. It was a move prompted by infighting between the Himalayan nation's premier and members of his party, including former Maoist rebels. Prime Minister KP Sharma Oli's government has weathered accusations of corruption and criticism for its handling of the coronavirus pandemic, but his decision to request a new poll comes after months of clashes with Pushpa Kamal Dahal, a former insurgent leader who helped him come to power when their political parties merged in 2018. The pair clashed over their power-sharing agreement. Fresh elections will be held in April or May of next year, the office of the president said in a statement after she approved the dissolution. The decision plunges Nepal into months of fresh political uncertainty after years of instability and short-lived governments that follow a decade-long civil war. Analysts said the dissolution of parliament was likely to be challenged in court. And U.S. President-elect Joe Biden said, "We literally have no time to waste," as he introduced the six-member team that will advance his climate change and energy agenda. Environmental groups have largely praised the team. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the Trump administration brokers a deal to normalize relations between Israel and Morocco. But many analysts are asking, at what cost? Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Morocco, which at one time boasted a significant Jewish population, has maintained informal relations with the Jewish state for decades. King Hassan II, the father of King Mohammed VI, was instrumental behind the scenes in fostering Arab-Israeli peace. Morocco is the only Arab country whose constitution, redrafted in 2011, includes a reference to the country's Hebraic roots. Jews have lived in Morocco for more than 2,000 years. In 1492, Jews fleeing the Spanish Inquisition found refuge in Muslim Morocco and in several other North African countries. Today, thousands of Israelis of Moroccan descent travel to the land of their ancestors every year, while Israeli officials and ordinary citizens are excited to reap the economic, political, and cultural benefits from normalizing ties with Morocco. Regional analysts and diplomats question the quid pro quo that Rabat apparently extracted from Washington. The United States brokered the Abraham Accords between the UAE and Israel in return for a halt to Israeli annexation of Palestinian territory. In the case of Morocco, President Trump on December 10th signed a proclamation recognizing Morocco's sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara, a disputed territory Morocco took by force in 1975 following Spain's withdrawal. Until now, the United States has taken a more neutral stance by supporting longstanding UN efforts to determine the future of the territory and its people in a manner that supports the principle of self-determination. In a recent opinion editorial in the Washington Post, former U.S. Secretary of State James Baker, who later served as the U.N. Secretary General's personal envoy for the Western Sahara from 1997 to 2004, lamented the trade-off. In his view, quote, "We should not simply turn our backs on the people of Western Sahara as we try to promote better relations between Israel and her Arab neighbors." He went on to say that, quote, "The Trump administration's recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara is a major and unfortunate change in longstanding U.S. policy under both Democratic and Republican administrations." For more on the significance and implications of Moroccan-Israeli rapprochement in exchange for U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the entire Western Sahara, we're joined by two top regional analysts. William Lawrence is a professor of political science and international affairs at American University's School of International Service and a former senior diplomat and North Africa program director at the International Crisis Group. And Rob Satloff, he is the executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. That's a policy group based here in Washington. He's an expert on Arab and Islamic policies and U.S. policy toward the Middle East. And both gentlemen join me via Microsoft Teams. Welcome to the program. Rob Satloff, let me start with you. What's your overall assessment on U.S. recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over the Western Sahara and the Moroccan-Israel deal?
Well, I think it's important to recognize there's two very different understandings that just occurred. One between the United States and Morocco, and the second between the Kingdom of Morocco and the State of Israel. And they really are very separate agreements. They are linked, of course, but it's not as though the Israelis secured recognition of Western Sahara for Morocco. That was an American decision. I think it's obviously a beneficial and good that Morocco and Israel are on the process of normalizing relations. I think we should be a little bit modest. The Kingdom of Morocco agreed so far only to return relations to where they were about 18 years ago, before the second Palestinian uprising. That was a time after a major Middle East event occurred, namely Morocco hosting the economic component of the original Oslo Accords, something called the Casablanca Conference. And that launched Moroccan-Israeli relations in a public sense with liaison offices between the two. Those liaison offices were suspended when the violence erupted between Israelis and Palestinians. And the King of Morocco only so far has promised to resume that. There is a sense that he's going to go further. I think what he's waiting for full relations, is to see whether the Biden administration affirms President Trump's commitment on Western Sahara. And that really is the most controversial aspect of this, because it does complicate American relations in Northwest Africa with the Algerians and other parties, and does raise some doubts as to America's commitment to the mediation and eventual referendum process for Western Sahara. So I think there's a legitimate conversation about that. My own view in one sentence: while this is a complicating factor, there is no necessary contradiction between supporting a referendum and a negotiated outcome to the Western Sahara conflict and American recognition of Western Sahara. I'm not necessarily saying this was a brilliant idea, but it doesn't necessarily mean the breakup of diplomacy or the onset of conflict in Northwest Africa.
Turning to you, Bill Lawrence, for your take on these agreements. As Rob said, these are separate agreements, but there is a linkage, certainly in the mind of the Moroccans, that their resumption of these ties with Israel are definitely linked to the U.S. recognition of the Western Sahara.
Let me start by saying, and thanks for inviting me, that this is a really, really difficult topic for me, because I've spent so much of my career defending the rights and safety of Israelis, the rights and safety of Palestinians, the rights and safety of Moroccans, and the rights and safety of Saharans. And so what this set of deals does is put in conflict to some degree all of these interests that I have in defending these populations' interests. And it's really quite difficult. Let me also say that while these two agreements should be disconnected and could be disconnected, they are connected. And right at the moment where the ceasefire since 1991, negotiated in advance of James Baker's wonderful service as the UN envoy, fell apart about a month ago, and the war officially began again. So it fell at that very bad time. And by connecting the occupied Western Sahara to the occupied Palestinian areas, these two issues are linked in the minds of lots of populations. So all of that is really difficult. And I think by linking the issues, we've done disservice to both issues. We've made the likelihood of greater conflict much greater. And while both the Saharans and the Moroccans are saying they don't want war, both are being pushed towards war by the current situation. And at a minimum, the Biden administration is going to have a bit of a hard time helping tamp down the escalatory actions and escalatory language on both sides, which could lead to a hot war again. And that's why so many congresspeople from across the political spectrum, so many international organizations like the European Union and the UN and the African Union and so many others are condemning this action, because in part of the threat of war, in addition to the principles at stake. And so, as Robert said in different terms, this is, in my mind, probably been done the wrong way. Obviously, when you stoke the flames of this sort of situation, good things can come out of it. But what was already a thorny diplomatic conundrum has become doubly thorny because of the threat of war here. And for that reason, the Biden administration is going to have to give it some great due diligence early in the administration, right at the time where Biden would like to be mostly focused on renewing ties with Europe, confronting the Russians, issues like Syria and Yemen and Libya, rather than this. But the Trump administration has added this to the list.
Both of you have analyzed this very well, but very briefly, before we go to a break, let's step back for a minute. Rob Satloff, why is the Western Sahara so important to Morocco? Why does it spend so much time lobbying other nations to take its side with respect to what it sees as its sovereignty over the territory? Why is this territory so politically, strategically, and economically significant for Morocco?
The Western Sahara issue is a point of royal sovereignty. It is a point of identity from the king on down. Morocco took this territory by King Hassan in the Great Green March in 1975. And ever since then, it has been the barometer of loyalty and deference to the king. And so recognizing this sovereignty, seeking international support for recognition, has been the litmus test of support for the Moroccan monarchy. Full stop.
Bill Lawrence, feel free to add or subtract. And also, can you explain if sovereignty, in terms of Morocco's definition, does that preclude a certain amount of autonomy for the Sahrawi people?
So on the first issue, I agree entirely with what Robert said. I would add to it that the Moroccan Sahara issue has become, as Robert said, in many ways an identity issue. And Moroccans tie their most important issues of national definition, national identity, around this issue. It's essential for them. And it goes back to the French colonial experience and the previous experience of everyone trying to break up the kingdom and take a piece of Moroccan territory and divide and conquer strategies. And Morocco is all about putting the kingdom back together, a version of the kingdom going back to pre-colonial times. But equally, the Algerians see this as central to their identity, and they see the liberation struggle of the Sahrawis as completely consonant with and linked to Algerian liberation. And for that reason, the Algerians are giving nothing here, despite rumors to the contrary, and won't, because they see the Sahrawis' rights to self-determination and liberation in a revolutionary sense, exactly what Algeria is all about. And for that reason, both countries now, as I said in the article, have been using more and more religious language over the last 10, 15 years, which is very concerning. They're calling it a sacred cause. And that's because it's so tied to their sense of identity, the foundation of the nation state in each case, and national identity. In terms of sovereignty, and this is misinterpreted all the time, the landmark 1975 court decision, which is the definition in international law of self-determination and a very big and important decision, did not, as many people say that Morocco had no historical or legal ties to Western Sahara. It said they did. It said they had valid historical and legal ties based on the Beya, the oath of fealty by certain Saharan tribes at certain points in history to the Moroccan king. But it said that the principle of self-determination trumps valid historical and legal claims. And then famous decision kicked the decision back to the General Council of the United Nations, which had already at that time voted for Sahrawi self-determination. And that is a key principle here and why so many analysts are connecting this to Kuwait 91, to Crimea, to the South China Sea, to East Timor, to critical issues of the right of self-determination where populations and colonies decolonizing or countries or areas of countries taken over by a neighboring power had their right to self-determine either recognized or restored at various times. And so there's a real clash here and principles at stake, principles that are at the root of the current U.S. standoffs with Russia and China. And so, again, it will be very difficult for the Biden administration in the early weeks and months to say, well, we're going to uphold this principle over here, but we're not going to uphold it over there.
You are listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are William Lawrence, from whom you just heard. He's North Africa expert and professor of international relations at American University, and Rob Satloff, executive director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, based here in Washington. And they join me via Microsoft Teams. We are discussing the implications of the Trump administration's recognition of Moroccan sovereignty over Western Sahara and normalization of relations between Israel and Morocco. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Here's a shout out to a loyal Facebook fan, Kofi B from Kumasi, Ghana. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our discussion. Over to you, Rob Satloff, to talk about how the declaration by the United States vis-a-vis Western Sahara, how that may complicate resolution of the problem in the United Nations. Does it hamper ongoing UN negotiations?
Well, at the moment, there really aren't any UN negotiations to hamper. So we have to see where Joe Biden takes this. My sense is I would be very surprised if the Biden administration reverses this 180 degrees. But there are other alternatives. For example, you could slow roll the implementation of the recognition commitment in terms of setting up consulate in Western Sahara. You could order a security review of the implications of the commitment and engage with the Algerians and the Moroccans to lower the temperature in the region before you take any other public measures about implementation. I do think we should put this in a little bit of sort of strategic realist context. The legalism is absolutely important. The practical situation is that Morocco controls the territory, has controlled it quite effectively for more than 40 years, and highly unlikely that that situation is ever going to change. Now, lending it legal validity, lending it recognition, it is a whole other step. But it's not as though this was either a live, actual conflict between two equal combatants about to start to burst into traditional war. The Moroccans have overwhelming military power. I mean, I think that's reflecting in the dominant reality. To me, the real regret is the old policy was just fine from the United States perspective. We had a very low level of conflict. We had a good ally in Morocco, and we had Algeria, which was increasingly looking to have better relations with the United States. So we had both of them, Algiers and Rabat, to differing degrees, vying for our good graces with our old position. Now, it remains to be seen whether our relations with Algeria have just gone bust or whether the Algerians might try to find a way to deal with the new administration, even with some slow but steady implementation of the Trump commitment. I don't think it's the end of the world, but it does definitely complicate the early diplomacy of the Biden administration and of Tony Blinken, who, as Bill just said, have a long list of other items that they're going to be focusing on, that they should be focusing on in the early days of the administration.
Tony Blinken, President-elect Biden's nominee for Secretary of State. Very important comment by Rob Satloff, Bill Lawrence. In fact, in the proclamation that the Trump administration issued on December 10th, it says the United States affirms, as stated by previous administrations, its support for Morocco's autonomy proposal as the only basis for a just and lasting solution to the dispute over the Western Sahara territory. So it's just sort of reemphasizing and giving that policy a bit more of an official luster. Nonetheless, do you think that the United States has unnecessarily poked the Algerians in the eye, as well as the Polisario, that this perhaps was not the best time to reassert this position, especially coming as it does apparently in exchange for Morocco's recognition of Israel?
Yes. Let me say that there's about 88 countries that have recognized the Saharan Arab Democratic Republic over the years, although that's been peeled back to something in the 70s now. There's about 60 countries that side with Morocco and favor its autonomy plan. But the United States is the first country on the planet of 195 that recognized Morocco's claim, and that's unnecessarily going too far. Let me also say that I agree entirely with what Robert just said about the de facto elements and the geopolitics of it and the Algerian-U.S. relationship. The only thing I would correct from what Robert said is the Moroccans only control about 75% of the territory, and the other 25% is controlled by the Sahrawis, and the U.S. just handed de jure 25% of the territory of Morocco that they don't even control, the eastern quarter and southeastern quarter that the Sahrawis still control and will not give up. And Morocco, even though it could handily beat the Sahrawi army, doesn't want to have a full-blown war with Algeria because Algeria will step up and defend their interests as well. And so here we are stuck with the U.S. awarding 25% of the territory, the Moroccans, that they don't even control. In terms of the situation at the UN, this really, really doesn't affect it that much because with one country recognizing Morocco's claims and the other 194 not, the UN process can proceed as previously going, which, as Robert said, was entirely moribund at this time. And we don't even have a special envoy at this time. We have a Canadian running the MINURSO, and it's highly controlled by the Moroccans right now. But if you look at the latest MINURSO report, there have been massive and increasing violations by both sides, all of which will have to be dealt with. And I've had extensive conversations with the Moroccans and the Saharans in recent days, and everyone's saying the Sahrawis are just going to go back to the same type of war they ran from 75 to 91, punching holes in the berms, lobbing missiles when they can, and trying to bring international attention to their plight, basically saying, look what we've gotten from 29 years of a ceasefire, we've got nothing. Morocco will probably have two camps, one that just wants to be done with it and take the whole thing over, risking a hot war with Algeria. I think that would be a smaller group. And those that want to return to some version of the status quo, which is exactly what Robert said, kind of would have been the better case of an Algeria seeking to come out of its own isolation and a Morocco whose position was favored by the United States de facto, if not de jure. And so I do believe the Biden administration is going to try to thread the needle. They're going to try to keep all the Abraham Normalization Accords on track while averting the hot war I talked about and slow walking or reassessing all of the commitments that Trump has made, not only to Morocco, but for Sudan, for the others. I think the most consequential and hardest to unwind of the normalization agreements isn't this one, it's the UAE one, because the UAE one's been linked directly to the annexation issue in Palestine, whereas this one is disconnected from any Israel-Palestine issue.
Over to you, Rob Satloff. Bill Lawrence brought up the Palestinians and the fact that there's no real linkage between normalizing relations between Morocco and Israel and progress on the Palestinian issue. That has certainly riled up the Palestinians and other Arab states who still see the 2002 peace initiative as important, even though it has pretty much been rendered, if not obsolete, then less important as a result of the Abraham Accords. Any thoughts about this aspect, the fact that these deals now, if not sidelined, then the Palestinians are not as key except for the UAE-Israel deal?
Yes, this conversation that Bill and I are having is very important, but I think the significance for Palestinians is it has nothing to do with them. And when you add up Sudan and Bahrain and Morocco and even the UAE, which essentially is a bilateral deal that took advantage of the tactical moment of the annexation debate for them to, trigger the move. All of this cumulatively tells the Palestinians that they are not the center of the Arab universe. It remains for all these states an important issue on their agendas, but for none of them is it the coin of diplomacy with Washington that they ultimately really cared about. For Morocco, Sahara was number one. For Sudan, terrorism list, getting off and reclaiming its spot in the community of nations, number one. Now, it's very interesting to see whether the Saudis, who are trying to straddle both of these, they want bilateral relations with Israel, but they're also very sensitive on the Palestinian issue. Are they going to take any steps toward normalization? Interestingly to me, the fact that the Moroccans did this incrementally, just liaison offices today, maybe something tomorrow, that's a very interesting model for the Saudis. The Saudis may choose this incremental approach. It differs than the UAE, which went all the way to full normalization in one fell swoop, one big step. The Saudis may see in Morocco something that they can swallow, an incremental royal approach on how to do relations with Israel. We'll see. But I do think it opens up a very interesting dynamic. And so we may actually see other news on this front before long.
Bill Lawrence, you get the last word.
I do believe wholeheartedly that the whole point of the Arab Peace Initiative of 2002, I believe it was, which was to trade normalization for concessions, has been abandoned. And that's a message to the Palestinians that you don't matter, which is a way to sort of restate what Robert was saying. And so the Palestinians are going to have to find new ways to matter that aren't the current, let's say, menu of options that have been given to them. I disagree with those who say that we can sort of set aside the Palestinian issue and do lots of other things and the Middle East can become a happy place, because I do believe that the Palestinian issue left unsolved is a gateway drug to regional instability. I do believe that you don't get Middle East peace once and for all and stability in the Middle East until you solve the Palestinian issue. But that's not happening anytime soon. Palestinians are going to have to also hit reset with the Biden administration and figure out new ways to get their rights recognized.
Gentlemen, a conversation surely to be continued in the new year. For now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, William Lawrence, Professor of International Relations at American University here in Washington, and Rob Satloff, Executive Director of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Gary Jaffe and Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on The Voice of America.
Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Ana Mateo. This program is for English learners, so we speak a bit slower, and we use words and sentences especially written for people learning English. Here are the stories we have for you on today's program. Dr. Jill Robbins brings us the education report. Jonathan Evans brings us a story about COVID-19 and how it is affecting a traditional Christmas event. I will return with words and their stories. Then we will end our program with The Making of a Nation, our ongoing U.S. history program. But first, here is the education report.
Dominique, not her real name, is a Black electrical engineering doctoral student. She found herself in a difficult situation at a conference. A white man thought a nearby Black woman was a hotel cleaner and asked her to clean their table. The woman did as she was asked, but she also told him that she was the main speaker at the conference. The man did not say he was sorry. He made a joke about how the woman could have two jobs. Other white people at the table looked at Dominique, waiting for her to approve of the joke. Dominique was not prepared for this. She acted as if she was laughing. The others laughed too, but their laughter sounded real to her. Leon, also not his real name, is a Black doctoral computer science student. He was picking up a visiting female professor at the airport. He had spoken to her over the phone several times. When Leon approached the professor, she backed away and asked him to call his doctoral advisor to confirm his identity. Ebony O. McGee teaches diversity at Vanderbilt University. She says stories like this are common. She has collected about 300 of them in her research over the past 10 years on structural racism in STEM fields. As a result of these incidents, she says, many Black and Hispanic students leave the STEM fields. McGee says the students spend much of their energy on so-called stereotype management. It means they have to take specific actions to deal with unfair and untrue beliefs they face as a result of their identity. McGee has found that the stereotypes also give Black and Hispanic students a stronger reason to succeed and, at times, to become the best at what they do. They want to disprove the idea that they are not worthy of being in STEM fields. Sometimes stereotype management involves putting certain things on display, like leaving a high test score on a STEM test on a desk for others to see. It can also involve keeping certain things hidden. Some Black students report that they kept their own children hidden to avoid the stereotype of single Black mothers. McGee says some STEM professors do not want to work with such students. They mistakenly believe they will have less time to work in the laboratory than students who are not parents. In her recent book on STEM education, she says it takes much of their energy and uses resources that could help them be creative. And that extra attention to stereotype management can cause problems with their mental and physical health. That leads to them leaving STEM. Research shows that Black and Hispanic students leave the fields at nearly twice the rate of white students. McGee says the answer is not to have more students of color featured on university websites or other publications. Higher education must pay more attention to the student's college experience, their well-being, and how others view them. She says more attention should be paid to the reasons that students of color stay in STEM programs than the reasons why so many leave. McGee's future projects involve students creating their own STEM businesses, she said. I'm Jill Robbins.
And now, here is Jonathan Evans.
COVID-19 is changing the way Americans plan to celebrate the winter holidays this year. But in Alaska, the National Guard found a way to carry out a beloved Christmas tradition for several distant Native American communities. An Alaska National Guard helicopter recently landed on a frozen field in Stevens Village, home to about 30 people. Townspeople hurried to the landing field after seeing the helicopter land. They watched as the soldiers unloaded boxes containing gifts for almost everyone in the community. Then the helicopter flew away. The yearly National Guard gift transport, known as Operation Santa Claus, began in 1956. This year, the operation required some new safety measures. For 65 years, we have not missed a beat, said Chief Winfield Hinckley Jr., the command senior enlisted leader of the Alaska National Guard. He admitted that COVID-19 presented difficulty for Operation Santa Claus. But he added, it will not stop us from carrying out this tradition. It is an honor to do it. In 1956, the remote Alaskan village of St. Mary's suffered periods of severe flooding and severe dryness. The townspeople faced a hard choice in the Christmas season, whether to provide food for St. Mary's or gifts for its children. The town chose food. Then the Alaska Air National Guard stepped in. The service brought donated gifts and supplies to the community. Since then, the program has grown. In 1969, the Salvation Army became a partner in providing playthings and more to children across rural Alaska. Each year, Operation Santa Claus attempts to get gifts to two or three villages that are chosen for different reasons. One village might have had a special hardship during the year. Another might have high poverty levels. Operation Santa Claus has provided for more than 90 villages since its beginning in St. Mary's. Stevens Village and two others, Birch Creek and Nanwalek, were chosen this year for the first time. Volunteers packed playthings, backpacks, warm hats, teeth cleaning supplies, and books for 127 children. In a normal year, the arrival of Operation Santa Claus is a community event. People dress as the holiday characters Santa and Mrs. Claus and their helpers. They celebrate with a party held at the local school building. All the townspeople are invited to have their photos taken with Santa and eat sweet treats. Gifts are handed out to children. But this year, COVID-19 safety rules required that the gifts be left at the landing field. Stevens Village First Chief David Kriska said having the National Guard choose the town was cheering. It was great because just being so locked down and with travel, you know, so out of touch with the outside world. However, Kriska wishes it could have been the full experience, including having his own children enjoy a visit with Santa. He said, "It would have been great for my kids to interact with them because they're needing that social interaction. I would have loved to have that picture with my daughters." I'm Jonathan Evans.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. It is safe to say that the year 2020 has been one for the history books. It stands out. And it is so worth remembering that historians will certainly write about it in history books. Sadly, 2020 will be remembered mostly for a bad reason: the coronavirus pandemic. It will also go down in history as the year of face masks and quarantines. Of course, 2020 did not start out as a year that would make history. It started off as just a normal year. However, when health officials said the virus had turned into a worldwide pandemic, that was history in the making. Countries closed their borders. Schools and businesses closed. And people stayed indoors. Although something good also can be one for the history books. For example, the hard work and sacrifice of healthcare workers during the pandemic is also one for the history books. The scientists who make an effective vaccine will also go down in history for their important work. History remembers some years fondly. Maybe there was a World Cup, a space launch, or an Olympics for the history books, but not 2020. Let's imagine that the year 2020 has feelings. It might feel badly to know it is going down in history as the year of the COVID-19 pandemic. It might tell us that a pandemic was not in its plans. It might say that the pandemic is not that serious. It might say everyone is making a big deal out of nothing. That would put 2020 very much on the wrong side of history. This phrase usually describes outdated decisions, practices, or opinions. No one wants to be on the wrong side of history. So maybe 2020 should just stop talking. If people had any goodwill left for this unfortunate year, it would be history. That goodwill would be forgotten. If something is history, it is gone, destroyed, or at least in very serious trouble. But 2020 is not unreasonable. More likely, it probably hopes that it will soon be ancient history. If we say something is ancient history, it is usually a troubled event that is long forgotten. People have moved on. In other words, 2020 may hope that we completely forget about it. Although forgetting about it would be foolish and even dangerous. Lessons from history can be important. In fact, we have a saying, those who do not learn from history are destined to repeat it. If we don't study history, it may be our destiny to make the same mistakes again and again. And here is another saying, history often repeats itself. So it may be a good idea to remember the valuable lessons we have learned in 2020. Even though it may have been a very difficult year for many people, we must fight the urge to rewrite history. When we rewrite history, we recreate facts to fit our own way of thinking or our own plans. So to 2020, we say this, do not despair. Do not be sad. You are part of our shared history. In your dark and uncertain days, there were also bright, beautiful moments. There were people caring for each other and selfless heroes. And we are not likely to forget them or you. All are destined for the history books. And that's Words in Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In our last program, we told you the story of the Statue of Liberty. It was given to the United States by the people of France. Lady Liberty holds a bright torch high over the harbor of New York City. Millions of immigrants coming to America passed the statue as ships carried them to the Immigration Processing Center on Ellis Island. Leo Scully and Morris Joyce tell the story of immigration in the United States during the 1800s.
American life was changing, and it was changing quickly. Before 1860, the United States had an agricultural economy. After 1860, the country began to change from an agricultural to an industrial economy. In 1860, American shops and factories produced less than $2,000 million worth of goods. 30 years later, in 1890, American factories produced $10,000 million worth. By then, more than 5 million persons were working in factories and mines. Another 3 million had jobs in the building industries and transportation.
Year after year, production continued to increase, and the size of the industrial labor force continued to grow. A great many of the new industrial workers came from American farms. Farm work was hard, and the pay was low. Young men left the family farms as soon as they could. They went to towns and cities to look for an easier, and better way of life. Many of them found it in the factories. A young man who worked hard and learned new skills could rise quickly to better and better jobs. This was not only true for farmers, but also for immigrants who came to the United States from foreign countries. They came from many different lands and for many different reasons, but all came with the same hope for a better life in a new world.
In the 1850s, America's Industrial Revolution was just beginning. Factories needed skilled workers, men who knew how to do all the necessary jobs. Factory owners offered high pay to workers who had these skills. British workers had them. Many had spent years in British factories. Pay was poor in Britain, and these skilled workers could get much more money in America. So many of them came, hundreds of thousands. Some factories, even some industries, seemed completely British.
Cloth factories in Falls River, Massachusetts, were filled with young men from Lancashire, England. Most of the workers in the shipyards of San Francisco were from Scotland. Many of the coal miners in America were men from the British mines in Wales. Many were farmers who came to America because they could get land for nothing. They could build new farms for themselves in the rich land of the American West.
One of the best liked songs in Britain then was a song about the better life in America. Its name, To the West. Its words helped many men decide to make the move to America. To the West, to the land of the free, where mighty Missouri rolls down to the sea, where a man is a man if he's willing to toil, and the poorest may harvest the fruits of the soil, where the young may exult and the aged may rest, away, far away, to the land of the West.
To another group of immigrants, America was the last hope. Ireland in the 1840s suffered one crop failure after another. Hungry men had to leave. In 1850 alone, more than 117,000 people came to the United States from Ireland. Most had no money and little education. To those men and women, America was a magic name.
Throughout Europe, when times were hard, people talked of going to America. In some countries, organizations were formed to help people emigrate to the United States. A Polish farmer wrote to such an organization in Warsaw. I want to go to America, but I have no money. I have nothing but the 10 fingers of my hands, a wife, and 9 children. I have no work at all, although I am strong and healthy and only 45 years old. I have been to many towns and cities in Poland, wherever I could go. Nowhere could I earn much money. I wish to work, but what can I do? I will not steal, and I have no work. So I beg you to accept me for a journey to America.
As the years passed, fewer people were moving to America for a better job. Most were coming now for any job at all. Work was hard to find in any of the cities in Europe. A British lawmaker told Parliament in 1870 that Englishmen were leaving their country not because they wanted to, but because they had to. They could not find work at home. He said that even as he spoke, hundreds were dying of hunger in London and other British cities. They were victims of the new revolution in agriculture and industry. Small family farms were disappearing. In their places rose large, modern farms that could produce much more. New machines took the place of men, and millions of farmers had to look for other work. Some found it in the factories. Industry was growing quickly, but not quickly enough to give jobs to all the farmers out of work.
In the next 10 years, millions of people made the move from Britain, Germany, and the Scandinavian countries. But then, as industry in those countries grew larger and more jobs opened, the flood of immigration began to slow. The immigrants now were coming from southern and eastern Europe. Anti-Jewish feeling swept Russia and Poland. Violence against Jews caused many of them to move to America. In the late 1880s, cholera spread through much of southern Italy. Fear of the disease led many families to leave for the United States. Others left when their governments began building up strong armies. Young men who did not want to be soldiers often escaped by moving to America. Big armies were costly, and many people left because they did not want to pay the high taxes. Whatever the reason, people continued to immigrate to the United States.
These new immigrants were not like those who came earlier. These new immigrants had no skills. Most were unable to read or write. Factory owners found that these Eastern and Southern Europeans were hard workers. They did not protest because the work was hard and the pay was low. They did not demand better working conditions. They did not join unions or strike. Factory owners began to replace higher-paid American and British workers with the new immigrants. Business leaders wanted more of the new workers. They urged the immigrants to write letters to their friends and relatives in the old country. Tell them to come to America, that there are plenty of jobs.
Letters from America brought many more immigrants. The big steamship companies also helped industry to get more of the new workers. They paid thousands of agents throughout Europe to sell tickets for the trip to America. Their efforts meant that steamships bringing grain to Europe could return to America filled with immigrants. They came by the hundreds of thousands, people of all religions from all across Europe. Many remained in New York and other eastern cities, but many others moved westward. they took jobs in the steel factories of Pennsylvania and the coal mines of West Virginia. They worked in the lumber camps of Michigan and in the stockyards and meat packing plants of Chicago.
Within a few years, foreign-born workers held most of the unskilled jobs in many American industries. American workers began to protest. They demanded an end to the flood of immigration. That will be our story in the next program of The Making of a Nation.
And that is our program for today. Thank you for listening. Join us again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Ana Mateo.